Well, I did not stay long in that city, for it happened to be in the fall, and I never reefed sail in my rigging till I anchored upon the canal. And when I arrived at the workings, I was filled with the greatest surprise, for to see such a fine undertaking, oh, the likes of it opened my eyes. Soon I learned for to be very handy, to use both the hammer and spade. And there I learned the fine art of canaling, and I find it an elegant trade. Well, I worked with 1,000 brave navvies. We worked among mountains so tall. We were dragging a chain through the mountains to strike a line for the canal.
Welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. That was a snatch of Paddy on the Canal, sung by the late, great Frank Hart. For today, we're looking at the history of Irish canals, and I'm joined by Eugene Coyle, fellow of the Royal Historical Society, and more importantly, author of Ireland's Canal Navigators, which is in the forthcoming or the latest issue of History Ireland magazine. David Dixon, Professor of Modern History at Trinity College Dublin, and author of The First Irish Cities, an 18th Century Transformation. And that was published this year by Yale University Press. And that book, of course, is reviewed also in the same issue of History Ireland. Nuala Riley, archivist with Waterways Ireland. And finally, Alexander O'Faley, historian, tour guide, and importantly, canal boat resident. More on that later. And this head school is supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund. Now, David Dixon, if I could go to you first, and I think that this is probably partly dealt with in your book, what drove the construction of canals in 18th century Ireland?
Well, it's a long story right through the 18th century. The talk about waterway improvement, inland navigation improvement, if you like, canals and their possible benefits were in the air really almost from the time of King William's reign. And in other words, it's something that stretches back into the 17th century. And a lot of people were aware of the importance of canals, say, in the enormous prosperity of the Dutch Republic, and beginning to see the benefit of inland river improvements across the water in England. But despite all the talk, there's really very little to show for it, certainly until the Newry Canal, which is a minor enough challenge, was built in the 1730s and early 40s. But the big change really comes about at mid-century, in the middle of the 18th century, when on the one hand, the economy becomes much stronger, and on the other, where there's more money around both public and private to start doing things. So I suppose really the real history of our canals, certainly seen from a Dublin perspective, comes around the middle of the century, and really it's the next 70 years in which so much of the history takes place.
Now, before we get too Dublin-centric here, of course, I want to go to Eugene Coyle. On when the first summit level canal was built in Ireland, and before I go to Eugene, maybe I'll go to Alexander, because you're a technical man here, actually living on the canal, right? What is a summit level canal?
I suppose the simplest explanation would be that it's a canal that connects two river valleys that has to progress over high ground. That's the easiest way of explaining it. So, for example, the Grand Canal, the Royal Canal, I think every canal in Ireland is a summit level canal. The first you would have had in China, again, 2,000 plus years ago, but in terms of Europe, 17th century, about the 1680s in France, you have the Canal du Midi, which connected the Bay of Biscay, Atlantic, and the Mediterranean, rose about 62 metres. And so in Ireland, I think the Newry Canal was a summit level canal. As we said, I think it was the only one. We only have summit level canals here. And so it would have been before even England had its first summit level canal. So broadly speaking, that's kind of what they are.
Well, maybe I've got to Eugene. Eugene, so what was the first summit level canal built in Ireland?
Well, Tommy, thank you. The first level summit canal in Ireland was the Newry Canal, basically, and it actually predated both the English canals, the Manchester Canal, as well as the Sankey Canal in the northwest of England.
So Eugene, that's interesting. So we were in first. The first canal in these islands was built in Ireland rather than Britain.
Not alone in Ireland, but in Great Britain as well. I think maybe Alex might be able to correct me on this one, but some canals were built in France, weren't they, during the very early part of the 17th century? But I'm not 100% sure. The point is about the Newry Canal. It was built with a motivation to beat the coal monopoly that English coal merchants had on Dublin City, and particularly on Dublin Corporation. David sort of briefly mentioned it there, but the Irish coal industry, well, as we all know, Irish industry in general depended upon coal, and all industries do, but 17th century Ireland had very few coal reserves, very, very few. They had one in the Leinster coal fields around Kilkenny and the Arigna coal field around Roscommon. But the coal mine there was just anthracite, and it was Arigna. And it was, I beg pardon, mostly lignite. And however, around about 1698, and really into the beginning of the 18th century and around 1704, bituminous coal was found around Lough Neagh. They thought was quite large quantities of it. And the government considered that possibly this is one way it beat the English monopoly, was to import coal from the Tyrone coal fields into Dublin via Newry. So the only way that could be done was to build a canal. And the coal miners and obviously the landowners around in County Antrim and County Armagh and County Tyrone lobbied heavily the House of Commons for financial support to build that. And to build a waterway to transport coal from Newry and then to by sea to Dublin. In 1729, as David also mentioned, the House of Commons created the Irish Commissioners of Inland Navigation, who were a unique body in both Ireland and in England and throughout the United Kingdom, who actually gave government support to build a canal, whereas in England, there was no government support for the Manchester Canal or for the Sankey Canals or even subsequent canals, and built up a massive, like the railway mania, built up a massive private industry in building canals. There was a monopoly, and as I said, the Cheshire coal miners and coal fields had a monopoly in importing coal directly into Dublin. And the construction of the Newry Canal took place in 1731, which linked the upper band outside Portadown eastwards for about 19 miles along the present-day Louth Down border to the market town of Newry, entering the Irish Sea at Carlingford Lock in 1742, 11 years later, which was a record. It was a very challenging terrain to go through. As Alex pointed out, it was a summit canal. It had to go from two river valleys up to a mountain or through a mountain and come out the other side. The market town of Newry benefited enormously because it was in a very bad way after the 1690s. And it was just a small market town, more or less derelict. And then suddenly, the canal arrived in 1742, and with a great hope that Dublin will benefit mostly from the business generated from Newry and the coal that was coming out of Newry Port. Over the next century, the canal had significant effect on the townscape and economy of the town, transforming a small market town to a sizable maritime port, trading with the West Indies and the Americas.
Now, Eugene, you said, you know, suddenly the canal arrived in Newry, and when you talk about a 10-year construction, that's sudden enough, like in canal terms. Can just moving back to Dublin here, right, and the Grand Canal, right, because a big contrast there, as David said, first mooted in the 1690s, but it didn't start till 1757, and then it finished the Ring's End in 1804. Now, that's 47 years, right?
Yeah.
7.7 metres per day, I reckon. David, can I come to you, like, why did it take so long? And I'm just wondering, was finance an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that where you have, let's say, uncertain commercial prospects compared to some of the situation in the northwest of England, the private capital, you might say, was understandably rather wary of some of the projectors, and public money came in sort of fits and starts. And if you take the Grand, I mean, it has its first phase with essentially parliamentary money, then it becomes very much the kind of the child of Dublin Corporation for almost a decade. And then it becomes a funding is responsibility for its construction are taken over by a private incorporated company in 1772. And it's really only from that point that you begin to see a movement. And indeed, it's the end of that decade that the first services for a short distance begin on the Grand. But I suppose the thing to really say is, I mean, it wasn't entirely clear how, if you like, this investment was going to be justified, because the initial assumptions about coal, you know, as Eugene has said, were wildly optimistic. And what really, I think, justified the enormous amount spent on the Grand Canal came from the growth of tillage within the large hinterland of the Grand Canal. And if you like, changes that were going on in the wider economy in the late 1700s, when the canal was coming into existence, which were not there when people were talking about a canal 30, 40, 50 years before. It really would make no sense to have invested that kind of money, say, in Swift's time. But it did make sense, and the business really was there as the canal began to fill out its network, the Grand Canal began to fill out its network in the final decades of the 1700s. And shortly after 1800, there's no doubt that it was a very busy transport system at that point. But would it have been 50 years before? I doubt it.
Now, Alex, the Grand Canal ended up costing about, the figure I have here is about £900,000, right? Now, why did it cost so much? I mean, compared to Britain, for example, and the Royal Canal similarly later.
Yeah, I mean, the actual total debt, if you include the hotels and Salins, Portobello, Robertson, etc., everything included was close to £1 million, actually. So it was quite expensive. You compare that to the Trent Mersey Canal, which was only 300,000, which was around the same length and was a summit level canal as well.
Yeah.
It is truly remarkable how much it did cost. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that happened. Terrible planning very early on. The route was just not properly surveyed by Thomas Omer. That's how you pronounce his name. And it was repeatedly changed. It was different engineers over the years. The locks themselves had to be changed in size from something like, I think, 140 feet by 60 feet to down to closer to what it is today, which is about 60 feet by 14 feet. I mean, there's a lot going on there. The Bog of Allen cost a huge amount of money to get the canal across that. There's also the price of land, as it is today in Ireland. You know, the price of land back then. It was very expensive to buy land, and the landowners didn't give it up easily. And so there's a lot going on there. And to some degree, there's issues with, though I think it's probably overblown, there's combinations forming in Dublin to try and get better wages. But really, it's a combination of really bad planning, price of land, and just repeated mistakes. Again, they didn't, you know, the amount of locks that had to be rebuilt because they weren't built properly the first time, cost, you know, all adds up over the time, you know.
And any implication of corruption?
There's some jobbery going on. I think it's more common on the Royal Canal, but it happens on the Grand Canal too, where, you know, people who are connected to members of the company who are on the board. There's a case with the Royal Canal where, I can't remember his first name, but I think it's John McMahon, was a member of the Royal Canal board. He actually resigned so that he can get a tender to kind of do the Longford line. So it, corruption was there in some fashion. Whether, and in particular with the Royal Canal, it's interesting when the state kind of takes over, when the directors take over, the price of per square, I think per mile of the canal, it decreases from about £20,000 per mile under the company to about £8,000 per mile under the state effectively. So there's something going on there.
Now, Nuala, can I bring you in there? Are any of these financial records in Waterways Ireland's current archives?
No, unfortunately not. Any of the journals or minute books that we hold in the archive really only date from the early 1830s onwards. Oh. And so really anything before that, we don't have any records whatsoever.
Well, that's very disappointing. No smoking guns in your records.
Unfortunately not, no.
Eugene, I want to bring you in on this, right, on the question of why it took so long to build the Grand Canal, possible technical problems, because Alex has alluded to this, crossing the Bog of Allen. Now, can I just say that I did actually traverse the Grand Canal once myself, about 40 years ago, from Shannon Harbour to Ringsend. And when I get into the middle of the country, I was thinking, oh, this is very handy, you know, there's no locks at all, nice straight run, you know, through Offaly into Kildare. But in fact, The Bog of Allen might as well have been a sea to cross. Can you explain, Eugene, what the nature of this technical problem was? Because it's to do with the construction of how canals are constructed.
Absolutely, Tommy. The Grand Canal, and indeed the its successor, the Royal Canal, had major engineering problems crossing Dublin, connecting Dublin with the Shannon. Both encountered significant engineering problems crossing the Bog of Allen. Now, we'll have to go back a little bit on the engineering techniques. Puddling, I don't know how many of you have ever heard about puddling. Puddling is a technique used extensively in canal construction and indeed in building of dams and reservoirs. It was originally invented, if you could call it invented, by the ancient Chinese, by the Chinese, over 2,000 years ago, and the Egyptians. In the early 18th century, English canal engineer, James Brindley, perfected the method. Now, what it means is, puddling is the technique of converting clay into a form of impermeable waterproofing and watertight cement, and was used extensively to line the sides and bed of a canal.
So you can't just dig a trench. Let's just make this clear.
You can't just dig a trench
and fill it with water. Yeah.
Water will fill in, the debris will fill in, and there's no particular, it just won't, sides will simply collapse. And they can't use rock, they can't use stones.
It's a bit like when you're building sandcastles on the beach, you know.
So this particular type of clay is not naturally produced. It has got to be made by hand, and physically by hand and by feet. You have to use a puddle clay is a mixture of loam, silt, sand, and sometimes extremely small gravel. And it's got to be brought to the particular site of construction and molded into shape. And it's very, very difficult and time-consuming to convert clay sand, this particular sandy mixture of clay, loamy clay, silted mixture, into puddle. It involves marching laborers dressed in high boots, marching in military formation across the mixture for hours on end to a depth of about a foot or a foot and a half. And they couldn't allow it to dry out because it cracked. And
this is made as they go. This is made on the site.
And it's very time consuming and exhausting, as you could imagine. Some used herds of cattle borrowed from local farmers and local landowners, or flocks of sheep to do the business, to force them, until this particular mixture got into the right shape and consistency. And it was used extensively crossing marshland and bogland. And then for marshland and bogland, they had to sink in a wood.
Rafts.
Yeah. In the same way as Gandon built his customs house in Dublin later on in the century. And it was floated, and then the puddling clay was placed on top, and the whole area was... it was a very, very difficult, time-consuming, and that's caused a lot of difficulties. As you could imagine, if they have to rebuild lock gates to a certain depth, the base had have to be lowered out, and it was extraordinary difficulties.
So when you're building over a bog, it's like you're building in a vacuum, in a sense.
You are.
Yeah. Well, now tell us, Eugene, about the, just explain to us the term, the barrow run, right?
The barrow run is usually not really marshy land, although damp. You know, you have to build embankments high enough for building, for example, to constructing locks. You have got to have things called barrow runs. Now, a barrow run is that they'd excavate the canal. It's very difficult to show you with a diagram.
There's an illustration in your article in the magazine.
There will
listeners.
Be, yes.
Get it in your local news agents.
So this particular canal structure, the embankments sometimes are very steep. They can go down to, about 30, 40 feet deep, as Alex probably would well know. They have to, the navvies or the workers, unskilled workers.
Just stop you there, navvies. Where does the term navvy come from, Eugene?
The navvy was a nickname for the word canal navigator.
Canal navigator,
were the men who built canals.
So this was done by hand then? No machines involved here?
Yes, indeed. It has got to be done by pickaxe and by shovel and nothing else. And wheelbarrow.
That's the height of technology.
Of technology. They had timber planks to run these, to build, as you asked me earlier, the sides of the canal, the embankment, had to be placed with, when they sealed it with their puddling clay, and then they placed planks on top of it. And this lined the steep inclines of these banks. So in order to get the debris up from the base at the bottom, you had a group of individuals, also laborers, digging out the debris, digging out the bed, putting it on these wheelbarrows. Now, sometimes these wheelbarrows had four wheels on it, and they had to be physically pushed up the side of the embankment to the top, where they were empty. Sometimes they had the assistance of horses to do that. Most times they had to push it, and it was time-consuming.
How much dirt could a navvy shift in a day?
Well, those who survived the tough work, and it was grueling work and physically very hard. You had to shift about 15 to 20 tons a day. That's what contractor agents would.
20 tons in a day?
Yeah,
wow.
20 tons, between 15 and 20 tons per day of rubble up this embankment, or to get rid of the rubble that they come across.
Now, Eugene, I want to bring Nuala in on this, Nuala, because you're telling me that you have drawings in Waterway Ireland's archives of the various tools used. Could you talk to us a bit about that?
Yes, we do. We have a couple of drawings showing the various tools used in the canals. The main drawing we have is a very colourful drawing designed by John McMahon, that was mentioned previously by Alex earlier on. And it's basically a very detailed design for a wheelbarrow, handbarrow, pickaxe, spade and shovel. So a few years ago, we actually commissioned the National Trust Patterson Spade Mill outside Belfast, and they reproduced the spade and shovel using the original plan and measurements. And a local carpenter with Fermanagh and Omagh District Council, they did the same and reproduced the wheelbarrow and handbarrow. So the plan was quite detailed. It even specified the type of wood that was to be used in these implements. So the carpenters were easily able to replicate this. And the wood was ash and beech. Now, the wheelbarrow, we noticed, was very, very heavy.
I'm going to ask you, did you get anyone to try it out? were they able to ship 50 tons in a day? I doubt it.
I very much doubt it. I mean, it's noted that the handles on the, you know, the spade and the shovel are very short, and the same for the wheelbarrow. So it kind of makes you realise that, you know, that these workmen weren't too tall either. And they're very, very heavy tools. We currently have the wheelbarrow and spades on display in our headquarters in Enniskillen, but unfortunately they're not available to view as yet because the buildings are still closed to the public. But when they reopen, people will be able to come in and try out the wheelbarrows for themselves. But again, I do stress that they're quite heavy, and it's quite remarkable that these are the tools that were used to build, you know, all the canals many years ago.
Okay, well, I think a bit between the financial issues and the construction problems, that explains why it took so long to build the Grand Canal. But David, once it was built, right, did it ever make a profit? And what sort of impact did it have on the city of Dublin, for example?
It depends, I suppose, how you calculate profit. But the thing is that a lot of the finances of the private Grand Canal company were in the form of share issue and bonds, and it was paying a dividend certainly through much of its kind of midlife. And those Grand Canal bonds were regarded as a very safe form of passive investment. And we find, you know, very large numbers of people, indeed even Catholic bishops, investing in Grand Canal bonds at that time. But I think, you know, with all the difficulties of construction of the canal and the, you know, signs that we have of, you know, project mismanagement and underestimating the kind of geological challenges, it's really it's important to emphasize that once certainly the Grand and even the Royal and some of the provincial canals got going, that they were relatively stable organizations, and their impact on both some of the hubs that were created by the canals. I'm thinking of places here like Tullamore and Athy and Mullingar, and on the city of Dublin itself. But, you know, before the railway age and even into the early railway age, were enormous. And, you know, the most obvious way to say it is, if you think about the Grand Canal and its impact on Dublin, we certainly wouldn't have had Guinnesses in the form that we know the history of Guinnesses without the enormous flow of barley and malt coming in from the South Midlands, coming in from Offaly, coming in from Kildare, right beside the brewery to the James's Basin. And, I mean, that impact on the town is kind of can be multiplied. I mean, we can think in terms of the impact on the movement of heavy building materials on bricks, the movement of fuel. I mean, all the talk about getting Irish coal to the towns, to Dublin early on, was to be absolutely undermined by what really happens. And that is that you get English and Welsh coal coming through Dublin and even through Belfast, coming along the canals into rural Ireland or into the provincial centres. Coal is moved by canal, but not eastwards, but westward. And that's, you know, one of the sort of staples of canal business. For the biggest city, for Dublin itself, I mean, a very important role of the canal was the movement of rubbish, of what was politely called night soil, down the canal and used as a kind of agricultural fertilizer right along the ribbon of the canal system. This is actually quite important from the 1780s. But I suppose a final point about impact would be to say, really look at the way in which the canals that run around the perimeter of Dublin to the north and to the south, the extension of the Royal to the Liffey and the Great Grand Canal extension down to Grand Canal Docks, framed the late 18th, the early 19th century city, and you know were in an enormous had enormous impact on planning and on amenity, and to a lesser extent that is true of Limerick and of the Lagan navigation in Belfast as well. But I think particularly in Dublin, the impact of the canals on the way people thought about the shape and planned the expanding city in the early 1800s is very important.
Now, David, if Dublin then had one canal from the from Dublin to the Shannon, why did it need a second one? So why was the Royal Canal built?
We could answer that in 50 ways. I suppose, I mean, there's a kind of the popular way, say, that folks on the board of the Grand Canal fell out, and Big John Binns and maybe one or two others, William Cope, said, well, we'll build a rival and we'll sap your finances and your business. But it's more complicated than that. I think basically, if you think of the timing, the Royal Canal as an idea goes back to the very early history of canal planning in Ireland. But the idea kind of was on the back burner for decades, but it became, if you like, a big idea, a new idea in the very kind of prosperous or frothy 1780s, when there's a lot of other canal developments, a lot of other big ideas in particularly the late 1780s. So it's in that moment of optimism. And you can see the launching of the company that was able to raise quite a lot of capital early on for a canal running to the North Midlands to get to the Shannon, to get towards what Eugene was talking about there a few moments ago, to the iron mines, the coal mines beside Loch Allen. And you could say that the Royal Canal was very unlucky in its timing. I mean, you could spend all our time just looking at the horror story in the building and the difficulties that the Royal had over its 30 years before it gets fully operational, so 1817, 1818. But I think perhaps the important thing to realise is that the topography was more difficult. I mean, it's not just the Bog of Allen, but a lot of other issues that the Royal had, running north, sort of west-northwest from the city of Dublin. And it was being built in much more difficult times. It was being, it certainly was hit very much by the end of the Napoleonic Wars. It was, it had overborrowed. And of course, the first company went through a kind of long death until it was bankrupted in 1813. The system was completed by state funding, and then a new Royal Canal Company was created some years later. Even after that, even in the 1820s and 30s, when the Royal Canal is, some distance behind the Grand in terms of traffic, but nevertheless is a busy waterway, it still had almost unique troubles in terms of the struggles with sabotage, the strikes by its own workers, by those who helped build the canal. In other words, it was coming into fruition in the very difficult post-war environment. And it was also, I think, very much going through a part of the country where agricultural combinations and secret societies were particularly prevalent. So the Royal had a very difficult decade, even in the 1820s when it was fully operational. But it's a fascinating story.
Nuala, can I bring you in there? Because you were saying to me that there's some references to this in Waterways Ireland's archives, wanted posters, apparently.
Yes, there are. We have a number of wanted posters, and they all testify to the sabotage on the Royal Canal. They were issued by the Royal Canal Company from about 1812 onwards, and they kind of detail the sort of sabotage that was taking place, and which included deliberate breaches of the canal, i.e. cutting holes into the embankments, vandalising boats, untying of moorings, and basically making physical threats to boatmen. So the wanted posters were offering quite substantial rewards of £50 and £100 upwards for information relating to these incidents. No records of the reward monies being paid out that we're aware of. So we're not sure what happened there. But the wanted posters are really for the rural sections of the canal, particularly counties Westmeath and Longford, and in particular Mullingar town itself.
Alex, can I bring you in on this now? What was the rationale for this this sort of sabotage? I mean, is this something focused on the canals, or is this just part of the general law and order issue in early 19th century Ireland, ribbonism and so on?
It's both, to be honest with you. You have quite a lot of agricultural combinations on kind of interacting with the Grand Canal when it's extending to Ballinasloe as well, but it's mostly the Royal Canal around the 1820s. So what I kind of touching on stuff that David already talked about, you have the kind of huge economic and also kind of, I suppose, environmental disaster that happens in 1816 and 1817. You have enormous unemployment, you have famines in right into the early 1820s. You have around the same time the Captain Rock kind of movement in the Southwest. You have the origins of the Ribbon Society and many other little groups that exist everywhere. And so some of it is to do with the political situation. A lot of it is sectarian in nature. There's a lot of the threats are directed at the lock keepers, who were overwhelmingly Protestant. And you also have quite a lot of issues with employment. So in terms of breaching the banks or just threatening kind of overseers, the hope here is to get work to some degree for local people. But it's also a part of the kind of the general prophecy that was going around at the time. I think it's Pastorini. I can't remember the exact name of the figure who came up with it. It doesn't really matter who came up with this prophecy. But there was a prophecy that in 1825, the Protestant population would be swept away and the Catholic, you know, et cetera, would be triumphant. And that was seems to have been a real belief amongst many people who are in these kind of ribbon organizations. And so there's threats. I think, do you humor me? I can read you actually, because I have Ruth Delaney's book here. There's actually a passage here about from a boat inspector in the early 1820s, and he is quoted as saying that latterly the ribbon system got to such a head, he had no power or control whatever over his drivers, as those that were correct and attentive were unmercifully beat and turned off the canal, and those that remained do as they please. And that's just one quote of many you can find in Ruth Delaney's work.
Now, Eugene, just moving things on here. We've talked about the building of the two big canals into Dublin. Where did it all go wrong, Eugene? Why? I'm assuming the railways were the death knell of the canals.
Well, did it really go all wrong? It badly affected the railways, William Dargan's railways in the 1830s, 1840s, and the peak of time was 1850s. That's a completely different topic and an extraordinarily interesting topic. But the techniques of building railways was identical to the techniques that they used to build canals. And the men experienced as navvies on canals automatically transferred their skills to the building of railways. So railways were extremely successful, and they increased this speed of transmission, as David was pointing out, between one area of the country to another, and the country became originally modernized. It had a very good effect as well on the road production transport, so the road transportation. So from the 1840s onwards, the business on the canals sharply declined in favor of a rapid expanding Irish railway system, which provided an efficient means of transporting passenger, livestock and heavy goods very fast compared with either a road or by canal. However, the trade decreased enormously on the hotels, on the canals, both on the Royal and all the provincial, the Royal and the Grand Hotel, Grand Canals, and those in the north of Ireland during that particular period. And the big hotels closed their doors. They became transformed even into barracks at one stage. The army took them over. And the canals fell into disrepair. But it took a long, long time. And in 1911, for example, there was a major British government inquiry, Royal Inquiry, a Royal Commission was set up called the Aberdeen Commission, which investigated the whole running of transport within Ireland, the 32 counties, both rail and canal. And its findings was extraordinary, to a certain extent, considering the times that it was in it. They said that the canals, in particular, when there was about 80 canals in Ireland in 1911, 1903, and about 1911, many of them not functioning as canals at all. They had become derelict and they were just eyesores on the environment, that they should be nationalized under local authority. It never took place because the First World War came in, and of course, in Ireland, the 1916 occurred, the difficulties about forming the treaty, the civil war ensued, and 1920s, the canals were literally abandoned. Even though, and the new government focused mostly on the reconstruction of the railways, because they figured that that was the much better way of conserving transport power within Ireland.
Eugene, I'll just come in there, right? Because I have it here, just one particular date which kind of sums up this issue, this shift from canals to railways. And that's in 1845 when the Midland Great Western Railway Company bought out the Royal Canal. And the reason for doing it was they want to simply put the railway line along the canal. Because if listeners wonder why is it that the railway line and the Royal Canal run in parallel with each other all the way to Mullingar, I think, is because originally they wanted to put the railway line along the route of the old canal, you know. So you have one transport system bought out by a rival transport system whose agenda is to eclipse it, you know, to wipe it out. But listen, I want to move on. We're into
just
the
one quick comment.
Yeah,
that wasn't unusual for Ireland. It was also happening in Britain, where a large number of smaller canals were bought out by these major railway companies.
Right. Now, listen. Before we move on, I just want to go back to Alex. Right. Now, apart from construction, Alex, I want to talk about working conditions on the barges themselves. Now, I'm sure many of our listeners, like myself, enjoy watching, you know, Great Canal Journeys with Prunella Scales and Timothy West or Sheila Hancock and so on. It's all very relaxed. And Alex, I paid you a visit there out in Enfield in your own, very comfortable canal boat. Right. But obviously you're living on that boat. Right. But if that is a working boat, I mean, there's not much room left for living, really, or for the people working on them.
No, especially if you had the misfortune to be on an actual working boat moving kind of materials, coal, turf, peat, etc., east and west. If you were lucky enough in the early days before the 1840s, 50s, when there was actual passenger boats, might have been slightly more comfortable, but pay wasn't very good. We're talking a lot of the cases, rather famously, the lock keepers were paid about, I think it was 9 shillings a month, which is remarkably small amount, or maybe it was even 9 shillings a year. I can't remember the exact amount, but in terms of people on the actual barges, yeah, it was tough. If you're working, if you're moving coal, if you're moving Guinness, you know, Guinness's finest hops west, it's pretty tough. You were almost certainly sleeping in the bow, 3 or 4 people in the bow. I didn't show you the bow, Tommy, when you're up here, but there's not a lot of room there. It's basically you're sleeping on top of each other. You're talking about, you get 24 hours off in a week, but that's all on the one day, on the Sunday. So you're working very long hours, probably up to 16 hours a day. Pay is pretty bad. The chance of drowning is there. A number of cases occurred, especially in the Royal Canal, of drownings, of boats capsizing. There was no insurance. So there's one figure I read in Ruth Delaney's book was that a family received about 10 shillings for the death of their main breadwinner, the death of the father and of the husband. So, I mean, it was very, very tough, and it was long days. Now, that said, most of the stuff I've been able to read said the same thing, which is that even though it was a very tough life, that there was a community that built up around it, both of those who were on the canal, those who, pardon me, were on the barges, those who were on the passenger ships, those who worked driving the horses, those who worked in the along, you know, in the ancillary professions along the way. And so, you know, when the canals did eventually cease to be a main kind of economic part of Ireland's history, that many of those who were made unemployed or by then had retired did miss the community. So as horrible as it was in many ways, it was a community. And that's certainly something I would recognize, because most people I've talked to who live on the canals today say the best thing about it is, in fact, the community.
Neil, can I bring you in on this? What sort of a photographic archive does the Waterways Ireland have of this, you know, of the last century, for example, of this period?
Well, we have two very significant photographic collections. One was donated to us by the well-known waterway historian Ruth Delaney, and that's quite a substantial collection, both of transparency slides and of, you know, old black and white photographs. And these are the photographs that she would have collected over the years as part of the research while she was writing all her books. The other collection we have is that of the late Dr. Ian Bath, and it's primarily a photographic collection of the Royal Canal, and it really documents the decline of the canal. And
I was going to say that they're rather sad looking, some of them, you know, because
yes,
it's dereliction, yeah, and, you know, lots of Gothic charm, you might say, right, you know, which is a euphemism for dereliction. Sorry.
But I was just going to say, but it also documents the efforts of, you know, the volunteers, you know, to restore the canal. And, you know, there would have been cine films showing various events by local, you know, Royal Canal Amenity Group members, where they were fundraising or lobbying for support to get the canal opened. And even they even installed lock gates themselves, you know, during the 70s and 80s. So really, without the efforts of the Royal Canal Amenity Group and those volunteers, the Royal Canal itself would never have been reopened, which it was in 2010.
You know, this strikes me as very similar to the fate of Kilmainham Jail, which for many decades was sustained by volunteers.
Yes,
and
that's
then
right.
Taken over by the OPW in 1986, as were the canals. And of course, that was crucial because previously it was in the guardianship of CIE, which is running essentially rival transport operations. So they had no real interest in doing anything serious about the canals, up to that point. I'll tell you, let's look on the bright side here, right? Because there is maybe not a happy ending, but certainly a more positive wrap up to this whole story, and that's with the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. Now, where do the canals fit into that development?
Well, a year after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement was signed, Waterways Ireland was established, and we're an All-Ireland Navigation Authority, and we're one of the six cross-border bodies that were set up. So our statutory function is to manage, maintain and develop seven waterways, principally for recreational purposes. So those waterways are the Lower Ban and the Erne in the north, the Shannon Erne, the Shannon, the Royal Canal, Grand Canal, and the Barrow in the south. And from 2007, we've also been responsible for the reconstruction of the Ulster Canal from Lough Erne to Clonus. So at an operational level, we've responsibility for navigation channels, tow paths, harbours, jetties, fishing stands, etc., along with locks, sluices and lock houses. And we receive funding from the Department for Infrastructure in Northern Ireland and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage in Ireland. But over the years, a lot of work has been completed. I mentioned the Royal Canal being reopened in 2010. We've also, this year, we've restored the 300-metre walkway across the Shannon at Mealach Weir. And a couple of years ago, we installed a floating boardwalk on Acres Lake, which connects Acres Lake to the Lough Allen Canal. So there's quite a lot of projects that we've been involved in, and we just don't have time to mention them all here.
So is it in the current issue of History Ireland, there's a map of canals, I think it's 1902, a very extensive network. Now, is it the intention to re-establish, you know, as much as possible of this network going forward?
Well, I suppose we have responsibility for the Ulster Canal, and we've actually received funding this year for the restoration of the canal between Clonus and Clonfad in County Monaghan. So it's a small stretch, but it's a step forward. And so this is the phase two of the restoration of that canal. And so that's great to see that. And in line with that, we're also working in partnership with local authorities in Monaghan and Armagh to create the Ulster Canal Greenway. So that's just, you know, some of the projects we're working on.
Alex, can I bring you in here? Because you're actually living on a narrow boat up at Enfield on the Royal Canal, right? What's it like? I mean, I did pay a visit. Very pleasant the day I was there, but year round, how do you find it?
That's a big question. I suppose the easiest way of explaining it is it takes getting used to. It's a lot. There are a lot of issues which are not the fault of any particular body or anything like that. So I'd say that there's not nearly enough funding given to Waterways Ireland by the government, or indeed by the Stormont executive. I think a lot more money needs to be allocated for that. So I think the current estimates are over 500 people or so live on the canals in the Republic. I don't have the figures on.
That's like a small town.
It is, yeah. But there's a severe lack of facilities outside of, well, and even in most areas, there's a severe lack of facilities.
And when you say facilities, are you talking about like plug-in points for
I'm talking about water. Just having water in a lot of places is quite difficult. So we're off the grid, me and my wife. We have solar panels, and thankfully we do. There are points that exist for electricity on the Shannon, I think in Grand Canal Dock. But outside of those areas, which are listed as residential areas, it can be quite difficult. And again, any person I've ever talked to from Waterways, I have the utmost sympathy for. There's a severe lack of funding for the waterways. And I think, you know, without being political, I think that many political parties in the government, many which over the last 20 years, you know, talked big, but really doesn't put the type of money that's needed into canals. I mean, all you'd really need to do is go to England and have a look at some of the facilities that exist there, toilet blocks, water, electricity, bin collection, you name it. Now, they pay a lot more for permits than we do, but you get a lot with it. And so most of the people I've talked to, and I did actually put the feelers out before this recording happened, I was asking, what do you want me to say? If you know, if anyone's going to listen to this, what do you want me to say? And all of them said the same thing, which is more funding, more cooperation with the Royal Canal Amenity Group and the Inland Waterways Association. But broadly speaking, you know, a lot more could be done in terms of funding to provide facilities. And if that was done, I think the waterways could provide an alternative, maybe not an answer to the housing crisis, because there's, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people can't live on the canals. But it's certainly an alternative. And it's the reason why I moved on to a boat, because I just couldn't afford the rents in Dublin. And these days, I couldn't even afford the rents in Longford. So, I mean, I'm not the only person who is in that situation. And I think waterways, you know, should be given the type of resources that they need.
Is there a kind of a potential virtuous circle here? Because if they up the facilities, that's going to increase greater use, and they might actually generate some revenue from it. You know, I mean, obviously, you're not going to be moving Guinness anymore on the canal, right? So you're talking about tourism, recreation, but if the facilities aren't there, it's not going to happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's problems with vandalism along the canal in terms of people. We won't name the people. I don't know who they are anyway, but, you know, we can kind of guess the age group here, what we're talking about. There's vandalism there, and that's, again, not the responsibility of waterways to have to police that. But in terms of having the canal at its best as a heritage center, as a place for leisure and tourism, but also as a place where people can live, you know, I mean, it's where people live now anyway. I mean, there's about 100 people or so that are on the Royal Canal, and the other 400 are spread out around the Grand Canal, Shannon, Barrow, Navigation, etc. So they're there, you know, whether people want to acknowledge that they're there or not, they are there. But as to what we're going to do about it, you know, how do we interact in the future and try and make it a shared space? I haven't really seen a huge amount of conversation about it. I think there's a general desire to not talk about it because, to be honest with you, the government's not providing the money. And again, you can talk to Nuala about that, both in terms of the north and in terms of down here. But it's, I think there's just a general desire to, at the moment, ignore it, which is a shame because I do think, at least for some people, it is a good alternative to spending, you know, enormous amounts of money on rent.
Nuala, Alex has given you a bit of homework there for what was hard to do. I'll leave that with you. But just to wrap up, Nuala, could you just fill us in on current developments, what Waterways Ireland has delivered recently and in the near future?
I suppose this last few years, really, our customer base has evolved and really grown from being primarily boating users to being walkers, cyclists, and increasingly used by small crafts such as kayakers and canoeists. I mean, during lockdown, certainly walking and cycling increased by 91% on the Shannon and on the Shannon Erin, and by 88% on the Royal Canal. So recreational or activity tourism really is kind of the way forward. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of the funding seems to be in that area. So we have been looking and have been working on developing blue ways or green ways. So with very much the emphasis on activity tourism. So green ways essentially are continuous shared use trails with a particular surface. And so you have the Royal Canal Greenway, which has a particular surface there and is enjoyed by both cyclists and walkers. And then you have blue ways, which is where the focus is primarily on the water trail and then supported by walking and cycling. So you have, like say, for example, the Shannon Blue Way, where you have like sections of the Shannon and it's primarily, it is a water trail. So,
I just know from my own, actually, that's one of the great advantages mm-hmm. of lockdown. You know, I explored all sorts of laneways, alleyways in my neighbourhood, but I also explored the canals, both of them. And there's been fantastic developments down towards the docks area of the Royal Canal in particular, because that was more or less a dead end, you know, because you just end it in this maze of railway lines and low bridges and so on. But they've built a very spectacular kind of a walkway, and you get a great view from it, actually, because it has to rise up above all the railway tracks. But listen, I'm going to have to wrap up there. But I mean, we're ending on a positive note here, because it seems to me that, you know, there is a renaissance in the whole canal network here, and you know, one that is developing. But listen, I'd just like to thank all our contributors here this morning. Eugene Coyle, David Dixon, Nuala Riley, and Alexander O'Faley. And our next History Ireland Head School will be on Ireland and the Greater War in Europe, Compare and Contrast. And our first live Head School, our first since March 2020, will be taking place at the Allingham Festival in Ballyshannon at 3 o'clock Sunday, the 7th of November, and that is Columba 1500, Man, Myth and Memory. I hope you can either tune in for the next one or maybe turn up for the live one in Ballyshannon. Thank you very much for your attention, listeners.
We worked among mountains so tall, we were dragging a chain through the mountains.